Hello, listeners. Did you know Jensen Karp has been doing his Earwolf podcast Get Up On This for over 300 episodes? To celebrate, Jensen is sitting down with hip-hop legend Method Man to discuss his music career, television appearances, From the Wire to the Deuce, and the debut of Drop the Mic, a show that Jensen created and is co-executive producing on TBS. You won't want to miss this engaging, candid conversation with one of the best rappers in the game. So check out Jensen's conversation with Method Man on Get Up On This, available on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or Earwolf.com. And check out his new TV show, Drop the Mic, October 24th on TBS.
Napalm smells best in the evening. It's not worth believing what you heard. Soylent Green, really, just a trisket, not a people biscuit.
Hello, you all. Welcome to another episode of I Was There Too. My name is Matt Gourley. I talk to people who were there in the greats and the classics, alongside the leads and the stars and the memorable scenes of film history. Today, I don't do it alone, because joining me as co-host is none other than Steve Agee, friend and fellow Meatballs devotee. We've been watching this movie together and alone for basically our entire lives. And our guest today is Crockett, don't call him Bobby, from the film Russ Banham. Russ turned out to be such a wonderful guy, and aside from playing the dashing camp counselor at North Pines, he's also an incredibly accomplished author, as you will hear us talk about in the interview. He's a Pulitzer-nominated journalist, the author of 26 books, including his international best-selling History of Ford, The Ford Century, and his book on the Airstream trailer called Wanderlust. Just a lovely guy who welcomed us into his beautiful home to discuss this nostalgic classic and favorite of ours. And stay tuned after the interview for a brief discussion between Steve and myself about Bill Murray's character and how he fits in today's context. Also, our quick take on the music from the movie by Elmer Bernstein, specifically the song Good Friend, sung by Mary McGregor, which is just an absolute sentimental favorite of ours. There it is. Please enjoy, and thank you very much to Mark Dowling for making this interview happen.
The film, Meatballs, the year 1979, the role, Crockett, the actor, Russ Banham.
Russ Banham, I'd love if we could start with you taking us through your audition story. My understanding is you showed up in jean shorts and no shirt. Is that right?
So I grew up in Queens, and Long Island, Jones Beach was maybe a 40-minute drive. And in the summertime, I sold hot dogs at Shea Stadium for the New York Mets.
Oh, my God.
And in the mornings, I would just hop in my car. It was a beat-up 1961 Biscayne in a pair of cut-off jeans, no shoes, no shirt, and would drive straight to the beach. And
this, so you would leave with no shoes or no shirt.
Exactly. I mean, because, you know, I'm going to the beach. And it was fun to drive with no shoes back then. I don't have the windows open.
I think it's illegal now.
Is it really?
I think it's illegal.
But I love the thought of leaving without it, and there's just no hope of having them all day, so you can't be blamed for living life the best you possibly can.
Well, yeah. I mean, I figured, you know, I'll just come back home and then put on shoes, you know, sell hot dogs.
Yeah.
And hey, be a can of beer, be a. And that's what I did. And my sister was with me. She's 7 years younger, so I'm guessing I was maybe 22, 23. So she was, you know, 15. And when I got to the beach, I called my answering service, and it was a message from my agent that a producer was in from New York. I'm sorry, in from Canada, in New York, in Manhattan, and he was casting a movie then called Summer Camp, and I needed to get to this audition. I said, well, I'm at the beach. I don't even have shoes or a shirt. She says, well, it's up to you. I think this is a terrific opportunity. So I said to my sister, we're going to Manhattan. And we drove to Manhattan. I left her in the car in the street. She couldn't drive. And I went upstairs into this room. And there were all the other actors in New York who kind of looked like me, who I would always audition against.
Yeah.
And I could just read their brains thinking, he's a genius. Look how he's dressed. He's a genius.
You probably had the tan and everything.
I had everything, yeah. You know, and yeah. I have curly hair, yeah. Not as much anymore. And it was, you know, it had the salt. Yeah. Teeniness in it, yeah. You know, and yeah, I kind of glowed, and then you know, Danny Goldberg was there, and Ivan was there, and I auditioned, and they loved it, and they said, "Listen, we're going to fly Sarah Torgov, because she was already cast."
Was she Candace?
Yeah,
okay,
my girlfriend. We're going to fly her in tomorrow. We want to see what you guys look like together. And they flew her down, and they looked at the two of us, and we both had curly hair, blondish hair. And I got the part.
Oh my God.
Wow.
No, serendipity.
You must have did you even have to speak? You're coming in looking like this perfect summer camp, like model. I mean,
you know, the audition was mostly improv anyway.
Yeah.
You know, silly stuff like throw the basketball to me.
Yeah.
I don't think it really mattered.
No.
Yeah. I just looked right.
How long until you were up in Canada after that shooting?
So we shot for, I would say, about 6 weeks.
Wow.
And it was really remarkable because we were north of Toronto in a town called Haliburton, uh-huh. Middle of nowhere. And there was we lived on an actual camp, actual camp on a lake. And we each had bungalows. Right along that lake.
Your own bungalow?
Well, so each bungalow, it was like a duplex, okay, right. in a way, you know. So I had my half, and then Todd Hoffman, who played Wheels, you know, my best buddy, yeah. in the film, was right next to me. And then we each had those bungalows. And then there was a lodge where we would gather after shooting all day with the crew. And there was a bar in the lodge, and we would drink.
At a summer camp?
Yeah, and then amazing. We would play poker, and Bill was on the lake too, and there was nothing else to do.
Yeah.
So we would all gather, and I played poker a lot, you know, growing up in New York, and Bill played poker.
Sure.
And he would always win. And when I asked him why, and he said, well, it's because I cheat. But you couldn't catch him at it. He was
wow.
He was that good. And there was a basketball court there and volleyball, and I think, you know, Ivan... I think he wanted us to live like that. So
that makes sense.
Yeah, we would just get really close. And we did.
Yeah, it does seem like the Meatballs film shoot was just as much a summer camp as the movie Meatballs.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah.
Funny.
And we shot that at another camp that was, you know, ongoing.
Right.
I mean, those aren't extras.
Yeah.
We didn't import them from Hollywood, those little kids. They were going there. And the fellow who plays the... Spaz's dad?
Yeah.
He was a local pharmacist in Haliburton. Yeah.
So to what extent locals. Were they the campers, like the little boy with the dead yeah. frog or the girl that yeah. delivers the gossip? Were they all campers or
all campers.
Well?
Oh yeah, they weren't cast.
You can tell sometimes yeah. in the acting, I think.
Yeah,
I think so.
Sure.
It's a noble effort, though.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So they just went there thinking, we'll just cast these kids from the camp when we get there.
Pretty much, God, yeah.
And amazing. They revolted at some point, too, didn't That's what I read.
Well, now, I read that in Vanity Fair, and I did not know that.
How funny.
Yeah, so I would imagine, like, you know, we were the CIT, so we hung out together.
Yeah.
And I would imagine some of the younger actors, they had their own little thing going on, and then the, you know, local extras and all.
Wow.
That scene yeah. you have with that little boy and the yeah. dead frog, watching it again today, it's a nice little tender moment, and I'm wondering how much of that... in the shoot originally that they peppered in some of the serious stuff. Cause I know that they went yeah. back and reshot more with Rudy. And
it's
did
true.
You have some stuff that you had shot that was later didn't end up?
Oh or, yeah, quite a bit.
Do you remember any of that?
Yeah. So there was these strings that ran throughout the narrative that involved me and Todd playing Wheels. And we would sabotage the other camps, the ritzy elite
camps.
The Mohawk, thank
yeah.
you. We would we would sabotage their cars. So we had scenes like that that eventually ended up on the cutting room floor. Here's a really quick, interesting story. So Todd and I became very close friends for many, many years. And when Ivan brought the film to L.A., I was here because I was doing a sitcom on NBC at the time. And Todd said, they're showing Meatballs to the distributors. Didn't have a distributor yet. And he says, I can get us into the projection room. I know the guy. So we went and we watched the original.
And you hadn't seen it yet?
No, hadn't seen it
at
all. We watched the original Meatballs, and it sucked.
This is pre the reshoot scenes.
That's right. Pre the reshoot and pre Elmer Bernstein.
Right, which is a huge part of this.
That music, yeah. It really is.
We talk about that song. Now, did he write the Mary McGregor song? He did, because that's in the score, that If You Let Me, I Could Be Your Good Friend. Yeah.
He wrote Elmer Bernstein?
I believe so, because that's also part of the score.
Yeah.
Yeah, with that missing, I would imagine you don't have quite the same film.
It was not good. And even my scenes with Todd, all that was in there, but it just didn't really go anywhere. And it didn't have that, you know, that depth of feeling, the bittersweet, you know, emotions you get from the film now.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it was Harold or Danny or Ivan, you'd have to ask them, who made the decision to, you know, to go back to the drawing board. I do know this, that Jeff Katzenberg, who was a production assistant at the time at Paramount, he was the only one in that room of all the studios that liked the film.
The first time?
Yeah, and from what I understand, and I don't know how much of this is apocryphal, but he went to Barry Diller and said, there's something here. And I think they came up with a little money to send it back to Canada in a studio where they shot the scenes with Bill and Chris Makepeace, yeah.
There is something about when you add that music, and I even read something you had said about how you watched it later and how it gives you this feeling of nostalgia. And we've watched it many, many times and we just laugh at it. But this time, this morning when I watched it, I felt not only a nostalgia for the film because I'd seen it as a kid, but also that time in life. And that music, it does kind of like put that bittersweetness in that makes it feel more real or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I grew up going to summer. Were you a summer camp?
No.
Yeah, me either.
Well, I remember we used to go. I grew up Catholic schools, and they'd send us on the weekends, the CYO, Catholic Youth Organization, upstate New York, but just for the weekends.
Yeah.
So not for a whole summer.
I went to summer camp from the time I was 8, every summer till I was 14. I ended up being a rock climbing instructor at the same summer camp. It was up in Idlewild, up in...
I have a cabin there.
You do, yeah. It's beautiful up there. So that's where I spent my summers. My whole childhood was up in Idlewild.
I never went
to camp.
Was it
the arts camp?
No, it's called Pine Springs Ranch, which was...
Oh, yeah.
It's just outside of Idlewild. There's like a Zen Buddhist monastery.
Yeah. That's beautiful, that mountain there.
Amazing. Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
I want to talk about something special in this film, which is one of the outfits you're wearing. If you can remember this, I'll remind you, at the CIT social dance. So you're wearing a like red cotton cardigan, overalls, but still no shirt. How much choice did you guys have in your wardrobe?
So I can't remember the costumer, but she took us to a, what would you call it? Like a thrift store, the crossroads we have
Goodwill
here now.
Goodwill or something, yeah.
Yeah, there was just this, you know, hole in the wall place. And she said, just go for it. You know your characters. What would your character wear? And I found that red jacket. After the film, my cousin Billy, who was younger than I, loved that jacket, and I gave it to him. I don't think he has it.
I wish I had it.
That would be a piece of memorabilia.
It really was cool looking.
Do you remember your necklace you had? You have a little blue tab necklace.
Yeah, so that was we all had them.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. But I don't know if they're in every scene. At least the guys did. Todd had one too. We just came up with this idea. It was a piece of string, and then it was like a little blue chip with a hole in it. And we wore those.
Little brotherhood.
But to me, the most embarrassing costume, of course, is the basketball shorts.
Yeah.
If you see clips from basketball in the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Like
they're short
legs.
Shorts, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, coming back around. Those shorts are coming back around.
Are they really?
Yeah.
So. That's too bad. Yeah.
By the way, everything, watching that now, everything that Spaz is wearing in that movie is so trendy and hip right now.
Not only that, but Spaz is supposed to be the social outcast. He's a good-looking dude, and I feel like he'd be getting all the ladies today.
Yeah, that's true.
He was also the casting director, is that correct?
That's right, yeah. And, you know, he's the brother to Len Blum, who wrote with Danny Goldberg and Harold Ramis.
That's
I didn't realize that.
The three of them.
How funny. So was he there when you auditioned, or were they just down there?
I can't remember. He might have been.
Yeah.
You know? But, you know, he came up with the idea of the Band-Aid, holding the eyeglasses together. And at the time, it seemed novel. It was like, wow, isn't that clever? And, you know, there was no Revenge of the Nerds. You know, he kind of, you know, predated.
Yeah.
He's a proto-nerd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that you would even call a nerd back then spaz just meant spaz. That it's just derogatory in general. Like, they hadn't classified nerd, geek, spaz, and that stuff like they have now.
Yeah.
It kicked off a lot of trends, too, because I feel like Bill Murray in that movie, the kind of carefree, you know,
the slacker dude.
Didn't care what anyone thinks, became just an iconic character through the 80s, like Val Kilmer in Real Genius. Like it was just a very, especially in comedies.
Bill was a completely unique human being.
Sure.
I'd never seen anything like that before. The only other experience close to it was when I saw John Malkovich on stage in Sam Shepard's True West.
Oh, wow.
I was like, whoa, what odd choices.
Who was he opposite in that? Who?
Gary Sinise.
Yeah, that's right. I remember when they did that. Yeah. That's right.
I saw
was that the
New
first
York
one where they would switch
Lane.
Parts? Or am I thinking of the Philip Seymour Hoffman?
You're thinking of John C. Reilly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that. I remember thinking Malkovich. I was like, what is, wow. You know, that's when you realize, geez, I'm not an actor.
No, you guys thought Dan Aykroyd was going to play this part, and it was up till the night before when Bill Murray.
Yeah, so that's
confirmed.
What Todd told me. So I arrived. With Cindy Gerling. They flew me in from New York. I landed in Toronto, and then it was a limo picked up. I was like, wow, a limo picked up Cindy Gerling and me, and then they drove us up to the up to Halliburton there, and she had said, it's going to be Dan Aykroyd. And then Todd corroborated that. So, but Danny Goldberg says, no, it was always going to be Bill. So I don't know who's right, but I am being absolutely, truthful that the cast thought it was Dan Aykroyd. And of course, when we learned it was not going to be Dan.
You're all bummed out.
Yeah. We were like, oh,
right.
No.
I think they were shooting Blues Brothers at that same time, right?
They might've been. Now they screened Animal House for us before it was publicly released. So we got to see for anyone. Yeah.
Wow.
Because Ivan produced that.
Yeah.
John Landis directed it. And that was just, blew
us amazing.
And Elmer Bernstein did that as well, right? Which is kind of like, they just like, keep it rolling. Let's go. Yeah. So how was it working with Bill Murray? I mean, I imagine there's no semblance of a script at that point anymore, right?
And it was a really basic script with a, very clear trajectory. You had the elite camp, and you had the ragamuffin camp.
Yeah.
And, you sort of know there's this Olympiad. I mean, it was just all pieced together beautifully. And we all did that, although Ivan encouraged us to improvise, our scenes.
Uh-huh.
But Bill just made it up as he was going along.
Yeah.
The first time I realized his comic genius was the scene where he's being interviewed.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Oh, at the bus.
Jerry Aldini.
And by the way, that's a local guy, too.
Seems familiar to me, that voice.
Yeah. I think he might have been a newscaster up in that area.
Yeah.
But he was he's not an actor. And Bill was just riffing on this stuff, talking about... they get this money and then they go around and get all this
sexual awareness week.
From all different countries.
They have to make their way around the world with $2,000 and nothing.
A thermos. We know way too much about this movie.
God, you guys do.
Well, I just watched it this morning too, so that that didn't hurt.
And that liberated us too to really go further in improvising.
So did you guys
none of us had his talent.
Right. But did you? So in a scene like the boat scene with the Candace character, was that pretty much, you knew what you had to do, just however you want to say it?
More or less, I mean, she likes me. I made that up and threw my arms up in the air. The whole thing when we're kissing and only my mother calls me Bobby, completely made up.
See that? Oh, now that's a classic moment.
Really?
That,
that seems scripted.
In fact,
I wrote in here that
I want to have a contest where Steve and I both take turns saying Crockett and you have to choose which one of us does it better.
Steve, you're an idiot.
Go, we're going to do this.
Go.
Crockett. Look at it. He's blushing.
Okay, all right. I got competition. Okay.
He's good.
Crockett.
Steve.
Yeah, it seemed forced.
Yeah,
it did. Seemed like you're acting.
Steve, I can really focus.
Thank you.
All
right. This is great.
Well, my hopes are dashed. That was the whole reason I set this up. Okay.
Oh, another line that I'll take some credit for this too is when I say, you don't see me, I say hardware.
Yeah.
You're a dick. So I did it, for the first time, and Ivan said to me, I don't understand what that means. It was such a U.S.
You're a dick?
Now, I like to think I coined it.
You maybe did.
Man, that's amazing.
I certainly coined it for the country of Canada. Because Ivan said, I don't get it. I said, trust me.
What did they use?
A hoser.
Right. Yeah, of course.
You're a dick.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
So Meatballs is theoretically responsible for putting dick into the lexicon.
That's correct.
And it's also the benchmark, and they set the bar for every camp movie afterwards.
It should have been called
Wet Hot American Summer. Yeah. Is so
yeah, that's a direct reference.
Direct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even horror films like Friday the 13th, it's still just that feeling of teens away with their hormones raging and that sort of thing. Yeah. Is this true? Because I read in, I think it was in the oral history in Vanity Fair, that the actress Christine DeBell, who played A.L., who I remember as a kid being so attracted to her and her husky voice. Yeah. Turns out maybe she just had laryngitis during that shoot and doesn't have a voice like that.
Oh, that I did not know. Really? All I remember is she had that husky voice.
No closer to the truth.
But we all smoked.
Yeah.
You know, cigarettes and weed. And then every night we would, drink. So, maybe we all had huskier voices than
it could be.
Would be normal for today's teenagers. Because they don't smoke, weed.
No. They all do ecstasy now.
My children don't.
How old are your children?
31, 28, and 13.
You have a 31-year-old?
I do. Wow. She got married 2 weeks ago.
You don't look a day over meatballs, Crockett.
Yeah, you look great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
I do need to add now that, he's wearing glasses.
Your son is?
Or you.
I am. Yes.
We're all wearing glasses.
Yeah. That's right. We are.
No. Indeed. Well, no, thanks. You're looking good. That, yeah. Hanging in there. How did your character get selected for the high jump? Was that just in the script, or did you have some kind of special attachment to that?
I think, that was in the script. I know Todd was, he was, I don't think it was in the script per se. I think Ivan sort of picked us somewhere near the end, but I was selected to do that. So I did run track in high school, and I had high jumped before. It's interesting, too, because, there's that line where I go to Bill and I say, hey, Trip, any advice? And he says, jump higher. So when I'm on the speaking tour, as an author, I have a book I wrote called Higher, and I show that clip.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I asked Danny if I could do it. He said, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sure. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So they can, they see me as a young guy when I jump higher, and they say, here's my new book.
High.
Anything else on Meatball for you? Meatballs?
I keep talking about meatballs for out. Was your hair naturally that curly?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I had a what we called a Jufro. Oh, I could show you pictures. I mean, I had a huge afro in college.
What was the diameter at its biggest? Do you think?
Well, I'm going to go like this. You got to tell me. Yeah, because I remember. I'd
Pilates ball.
I'd be doing this a lot.
Just feeling the sensation.
Yeah, that's great.
Girls loved to feel it too. They did.
Yeah.
But they kind of trimmed it, and then it got it was humid up there, and it really, tightened up.
Yeah,
and then it got straighter when my gray hair came in.
Yeah, you couldn't tell you have curly hair right now.
When I was a boy, a picture up there of me, I had straight hair, and then puberty hit, and it went, kinky.
Wow.
And then it straightened out. Strange how that happened.
Yeah.
Your hair's, kind of curly, Steve.
Yeah, my hair used to be really wavy and also way oranger.
Yeah,
like
I remember.
Was like...
Yeah.
Like carrot top orange, and then you get into your 30s, and it starts just dulling out and
pigmentation
coming ashy. And then my beard—I just started shaving all the time now because my beard is just fully white.
Oh, mine too.
Oh yeah,
it's getting there.
Yeah.
Well, we're aging.
Yeah. Well, me ahead of you guys.
Can't stop that.
I think you're looking better than both of us put together.
For real. For real.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the work you've done as an author. You just showed us this great book that you did on Airstream trailers, and it actually comes packaged in a metal case that looks like the siding on an Airstream trailer.
It's actual aluminum.
It's the same material,
Yeah, and the guys who make the Airstreams, they make them one at a time, made the covers for the limited edition of the book.
I'm so fascinated. I work a lot in my own home in renovations, and we're talking about buying an Airstream, renovating it, and using it just as kind of a guest bungalow or something.
We talk about that all the time,
really?
Too. Yeah, for the cabin in Ottawa.
Have you ever been to Hicksville Trailer Park out in Joshua Tree?
No, I haven't been to Joshua Tree, but a dear friend of mine has a house there, so we're going to get there. I've seen photos of it, though.
They're not Airstreams, like, but they're all vintage trailers, and they're amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what made you transition from acting into authorship? And
so, I didn't grow up wanting to be an actor. I wanted to be a playwright.
Uh-huh.
That's what attracted me to the theater, and a director. And I was kind of discovered. I was part of a playwrights collective, and we used to read each other's plays, and then we would give criticism. because we were all playwrights. And one time one of the playwrights said, hey, there's a producer wants to, we're going to do the reading of my play. You mind if he sits in? And we all said, nah, no problem at all. And the producer sat in and decided he liked the play, but he wanted me to be in it. And I was asked if I would be. And I said,
were you wearing just jean cutoff shorts and no shirt?
No, I wasn't. It was actually a very flamboyant gay character. And it was just fun to play, to sort of let loose like that. Yeah. And, kind of. And it was, because he was funny. He was a very funny character. And so we did it at the Provincetown Playhouse in New York. And then an agent came, and then, I was kind of discovered. And one thing, I was on Broadway, one thing led to another. When Meatballs came out, I was famous for about a year and a half. Norman Lear was doing a sitcom called Joe's World, and I co-starred in that with Christopher Knight from the Brady Bunch. Yeah, he's still my
Peter
best
Brady.
Friend. Came to my daughter's wedding, too.
No kidding.
And yeah, we've known each other 40 years. And when that show was canceled, it's Norman Lear's only sitcom failure.
You did it.
That was it. I was done. Bummer.
That was it. Yeah.
How was it working with him? I mean, the legend.
He wasn't there on the set often. I remember he was there for the pilot, and then I don't think we ever saw him again. Alan Horn, who had an illustrious career, still does, became chairman of Paramount. He was the producer of Norman's, it was called Tat Communications at the time. But when that ended, I remember I tried to, get jobs for the next year, and he was mostly sitting around by the pool. We were living in Westwood Village, and waiting for the call, and I wasn't getting any work, and I said, I'm done.
Yeah.
So I went back to writing.
You also, I want to hear a story about how you played a guard for the Rolling Stones on a 1978 episode of Saturday Night Live. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, I was in three sketches.
How did that come about?
So Matt Craven, who's just a wonderful actor of, other than Bill.
Hardware.
Matt. Yeah, Hardware. Exactly. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
And I didn't even recognize how good an actor he was, when we were doing Meatballs. But I remember Kate Lynch came to me and said, Matt's a really, really good actor. And she was right. And he's worked, nonstop ever since we did the film. Anyway, Matt came to New York. I was staying with my parents in between jobs in Flushing. And he came and he stayed with us at the house. And I used to meet Bill for lunch. And I said, come, with us, we'll see Bill. Yeah. So we had lunch with Bill.
Wow.
And Bill said, hey, we're going to start shooting the first episode of SNL. The Stones are the musical guests and the hosts.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I think it's like one of the only times Mayor Koch made a little announcement, welcomed everyone at the beginning of it. And so, we did three skits. I was in a cheeseburger.
Oh my God.
Skit. Whoa.
Yeah. I was in a.
Were you just sitting at the diner or what?
Yeah, we were sitting at the diner. Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. I had no lines in that one, but I did have one where I had Ronnie Woods. I had a rifle and I was pushing him up against a wall, and he turned to me and he says, "Take it easy, mate." Because I was, method acting. Right up against his neck like that.
Oh my God, I gotta see this.
Yeah.
I know, we're gonna try to dig that up.
You can, apparently.
Yeah. Hulu for sure.
Yeah. Wow. So what was that night like? Was that a crazy party atmosphere?
It was. So we spent we went just for one day to watch the Stones. And Dan Aykroyd said, hey, to me, he says, listen, can you do me a favor, kid? Would you run? He's like 2 years older than me.
Yeah.
Would you go down to the Deuce and get me some boo? I didn't know what boo was.
Boo? I don't know what boo was.
It was weed.
What?
So back in those days,
is this like how Canadians don't know what dick is? Like,
you got to go to Harlem to get weed.
I know. So I asked him what boo was, and it was weed. And went to 42nd Street and used to go to the back of the stores, and there'd be, it was like a bank teller, one of those kinds of deals. And they give you the little glassine envelope and you'd buy a dime. And so I did that. And that's when I smoked dope with, Keith Richards and Danny Aykroyd and Brian Doyle Murray. Keith! Here you go, Keith.
Oh, my God.
Keith. Isn't that what Mick calls him? Keith.
Yeah, Keith.
And then Danny says, listen, why don't you guys, I guess he was thinking, I can get this kid to pick me a boo any time of the day. Why don't you guys, spend all week here? And you can watch the Stones. And we did. And we spent all week. And then we did the show. They shoot it two times.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. I remember one scene getting ready to go on with Mick Jagger, and I'm sitting on a steamer trunk, And I'm laughing. We're looking at the monitor. We're laughing. And I don't know who's sitting next to me. And I look, and it's Mick. Oh, and he's laughing, God. And his face is this close to mine.
Whoa.
I'm laughing with Mick Jagger.
That's incredible.
I imagine his face, if you were in the same room with him, would always be that close to you. For some reason, yeah. He just seems like the presence that would always be inches from your face. You know, yeah. He seems like a close talker.
Yeah. It's tiny.
All
the Stones, tiny. Yeah. And their women then, who they were with, Jerry Hall and...
tall models.
Leggy, Amazons. Tall. Yeah.
Really. It's kind of shocking.
So what era... This is 78. I'm trying to think what was their album at that point would have been...
Some Girls. I think it was that one.
Okay.
Wasn't that the name of it?
God.
It sounds about right.
Well, you can look up that episode and you'll hear...
Okay.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. God.
So yeah, and there's a scene where Mick licks Keith's face, which I remember seemed really shocking at the time. And now it's just, it's old hat.
That sounds
familiar. Who doesn't
lick
your best friend's face?
All the time.
Yeah.
Were they also doing a concert in LA or New York at that time? Or
nope.
Just for SNL?
Just for SNL.
Yeah. Because this was, the second season. Oh, no, it started in 75. So this is the third season.
Third, fourth season.
Yeah, it would have been a huge hit at that point, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was just great.
So what are you working on now?
So I'm writing my 27th book. It's the history of Harvard Business School.
How did that come about? You go from Airstream trailers to
Boeing.
The Ford Century.
Yeah.
So that was the official history of Ford Motor Company when they turned 100. Uh-huh. And what's great about that book is my daughter had to do a report on Henry Ford. And so I helped her, and she actually quoted me.
That's
amazing.
I thought that was kind of cool. And Paul Newman wrote the foreword for that book, 600 words. And I wrote 60,000 words, and his name's as big as mine on the cover. But I'm sharing billing with Paul Newman.
Not bad.
Wow. Then I wrote the history of Boeing, and then I wrote some biographies. I did a political economic history called The Fight for Fairfax, and... It was, weird. It was just,
About the street Fairfax or that whole district?
Oh, that's it. Yeah, the fight for Fairfax. Yeah, it takes a look at Fairfax County, Virginia.
Oh, okay.
Which was it's the fastest growing county and richest county in America since World War II. And that's right after we won World War II.
Right.
Washington, D.C. was too small to accommodate the intelligence and defense agencies that needed to grow. So we could be a superpower. So Montgomery County in Maryland and Fairfax County in Virginia, which was nothing but scrubland, vied to become sort of the extension of Washington, D.C. And it's a pretty great story.
So is it just like a suburban community of intelligence?
Wow. I drove around. So University of Virginia and George Mason University commissioned the book. And I remember driving around. I don't want to give you his name, but he's a very, very wealthy real estate developer in that city.
Donald Trump?
No. God, no. Please. And I would say to him, I say, so he's actually the guy who built Tyson's Corner.
Okay.
And I would say to him, so what's that building there? And he says, he's like, I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you afterwards. Because, it was CIA.
Yeah.
An NSA, something like that. So that's where they all are.
I can't imagine if living in that neighborhood would be a blessing or a curse. Like, your secrets would be safe, but you would also have no secrets.
Right.
So, keeping up appearances would almost be impossible with all the miking and tapping. I don't know. Well, Russ, we can't thank you enough for this.
Oh, this has been a real pleasure. To look back at that film. I tell people I could write 100 books, and the obituary is going to read Meatballs co-star dead at 80.
Don't call me Bobby.
Yeah.
Don't call me Bobby.
That's exactly your memoir title.
The last sentence will be, he also wrote books.
27 books.
Thanks,
there
Russ.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again, Russ Banham, and thank you, Steve Agee. And speaking of Steve Agee, as mentioned in the intro, we wanted to have a quick conversation about watching Meatballs in today's context and Bill Murray's character specifically. This is something that came up with us long ago and made Steve mention that at one point it made him difficult to watch this movie that he loved. And then this conversation segues nicely into a discussion about Elmer Bernstein's score for the film and specifically this song that the both of us just absolutely love, called Good Friend by Mary McGregor, which we'll play right after this short little discussion. Also, there's a surprise appearance from my new adopted daughter. Thanks for listening. You can find out more about I Was There Too at Matt Gourley on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Also, I Was There Too on Twitter. And if you get a chance, give it a 5-star review. Give it a 7-star review if you can. All right, here's the segment. All right, Steve.
Oh my God.
For years.
What just happened?
Well, first of all, if you didn't hear it on the mic, Russ Banham is a charming piece of a man.
Yeah, very charismatic. That was better than I could have hoped for.
He's just a specimen.
Good-looking guy. The years.
Oh.
I was wondering about that. Do we leave that in, or are you going to edit that?
Well, I'll leave it in, but I'm going to turn it off. You tell him what it is.
Gourley has a...
I just want to hug you.
Gourley has this little doll that's on rollers, and it's got a motion sensor, but it looks like a little dead girl. She has green skin and hollow eyes and white hair.
You mentioned this is for Halloween. It's not like I just...
Yeah. It's a Halloween decoration, but it rolls around the living room, and it's motion censored, so it just goes off at random times.
Yeah, they
can't. Like now.
Anyway... We've been watching this movie for years, and about maybe halfway through our probably decade-long sharing of this movie, it occurred to me that Bill Murray's character, if you were to take it out of the context of this movie, would be the most insufferable human being. In fact, we've probably known people like this, someone who's always on, who's like... nothing short of an absolute sexual assaulter.
I think basically the best way to describe them is exhausting.
Yeah, like they require all the attention. This guy hangs out only with younger people. There's no one there his age.
Well, it is a camp, so
I know,
there's not a lot of options.
But it's probably because all of his friend group has ostracized him, and he can only go hang out with people that will look up to him just because of his age. If you watch it in that context, it changes the movie completely. And I remember I said that to you one time, and you were worried.
I was
that
like, you might have ruined the movie. But I hadn't watched it in probably a year or more. And then when you asked me to come sit in with you and co-host this, knowing my love of the movie Meatballs, I watched it again last night. And I'm still in love with this movie.
I have to say, same here, because there was a while where I had a little bit of a tough time watching it, just feeling like it was too much. But for some reason, the nostalgia really crept back in this time.
Meatballs also just kind of set the bar. It was the late 70s, but it set the bar for comedies in the 80s, especially teen comedies and the like, where there's always one of these characters, the kind of... he's always on, doesn't care about authority.
Again, it's, if this is a real person, they would be like despicable.
Well, if they walked into a party, everyone would be like, oh, I'm going to go get some punch and like kind of walk away.
Like in real life, we're all Mickey. We're all Morty in this movie.
Yeah,
going like, oh God, this guy, get him out of here. He's at every party.
Yeah. But he has become an iconic character, or not character, what's the word I'm looking for? It is like
an archetype.
Archetype, that's exactly what I'm looking for. Like I think I said this earlier, it's Val Kilmer in Real Genius,
right?
And all these movies had in the 80s had a character, and I think Meatballs was the first one.
The best I can figure as well.
And also, the nerd character I think came from Meatballs.
Yeah, we talked about that too on the interview. And yeah. The other thing I want to cover too before we wrap this up, and we'll go out with this, is this, not just the Elmer Bernstein score, but this song. And it's called Good Friend by Mary McGregor. It's written, I think, by Elmer Bernstein. Uh-huh. And you and I have sung this forever.
It's so funny.
We've used it in Super Ego for the end of shows.
Yes.
It is the sweetest song.
It's a great
song. This played at my wedding in the pre-ceremony music.
It did?
Yeah, like when people were sitting down.
It's a great song.
It is the sweetest, most like innocent, beautiful little song that I think I've ever heard.
Yeah.
And so we'll go out with that. And Steve, if you'll let me, I could be your good friend.
Matt, I will.
Crockett.
Don't call me Bobby. If you let me, we could.
Hello, everybody. My name is Jensen Karp, and I am the host of a show called Get Up On This right here on the Earwolf Network. We've been doing it for over 300 episodes, so we're celebrating by sitting down with a hip-hop legend, my favorite MC, Wu-Tang Clan founding member Method Man. That's right. For over an hour, we talk about his music career, songs he's released. We talk about his television appearances from The Wire to the brand new show The Deuce, and also the debut of Drop the Mic, which is a show that I created and co-executive produced on TBS. It debuts October 24th at 10:30. It's where celebrities rap battle against each other, and I swear to you, it's better than that sounds. I promise you that. But listen, you could download our episode now at Apple Podcasts or on the Earwolf Network and listen to an engaging conversation, sort of candid. A lot of stuff comes out with literally one of the best rappers in the game still, Method Man. We hope you listen, and yeah, whatever. Have a good time.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.